Q&A time once again. Today I'll be talking about government debt, health savings accounts, estimating taxes, and much more in this, the 96th episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
Hello again, everybody. How you doing? Happy you're here. Today is another Q&A edition, which are always fun, partly fun for me because it is less work for me to have to come up with content because I just let you all feed me questions and there we have it. No, today we got some good ones. Before we get into it, though, I wanted to let you know that my wife has this weird OCD where she arranges the dinner plates by the year they were bought. It's an extremely rare dish order. Wah, wah, wah. All right, that's enough. Let's get to it. So no, thank you for listening. We have a handful of questions today. I will start with one. This is an interesting one. Let me see. Did he give? Yeah, it looks like he gave permission to use his name. Name is Kevin. And Kevin sent me an email, and the email said, I was addicted to Hokey Pokey, but I turned myself around. Get it? Thank you, Kevin. I like that. I very much appreciate that. So Kevin's question isn't specific to retirement or tax planning, but it's a good one, and I'm sure a question a lot of people or concern a lot of people have. It goes like this. Are you concerned at all with the significant increases in government spending and national debt over the past few years? I think we are up to about $34 trillion last I saw. How do you see this affecting the market? And do you have any suggestions, particularly for retirees concerned over any short-term ramifications? Great question, Kevin. This is a tough one. There isn't, I talked about this before. I was on a podcast with David Macchia, who's a fairly well-known person in the industry, mostly around insurance products and annuities in particular. But we talked about this, and I forget exactly what I said, but I'm sure it's going to sound similar to something to what I'm going to say now. So yes, I'm looking as we speak right now, fiscaldata.treasury.gov, the current amount of total U.S. government debt. This is as of April 11th. I'm recording this April 15th, so there's a couple day lag on this. But this is the most recent data that I'm aware of. $34.55 trillion of total public debt. For what it's worth, $7 trillion of that is intragovernmental, meaning debt that different areas of the government have to one another, whereas the remaining $27.5 trillion is held by those outside the government, be it individual investors, institutional investors, foreign governments, whatever. So it's really large and it's grown tremendously. You just Google like U.S. government debt or trend of U.S. government debt, and you can see charts and graphs that show how much it's spiked in the last handful of years. Now, it was already on the rise, but then COVID really just blew the lid off with stimulus and tax credits and incentives and trying to support and prop up the economy for fear that, if there wasn't massive government spending in the form of additional debt, that the economy would just crater as people stayed home and stopped going places and what have you. So the debt is really high. And there's no trajectory that we see that it looks like it's going to get reined in or reduced or plateaued. To compound things, the debt that the government has generally isn't paid off. It's just refinanced. Like when a certain debt does come due, the government doesn't actually like cough up new cash I guess they do, but they don't pay it off from savings. They just issue a new debt. They just basically roll it out. And so like the debt is just sort of ever compounding and rolling and spiraling for, I guess spirals, depending who you ask, probably too intensive a word. But yes, the debt is growing. Is it sustainable? This is the million-dollar question. And I don't know. I mean, honestly, our monetary system is one big experiment that's relatively new. Like the dollar is a fiat currency, that there isn't physical backing. There used to be gold belying every dollar that we had. That was the gold standard, but that broke apart and was dropped some point in the 70s. And ever since then, we've been this sort of just IOU, like, yeah, we're gonna literally just print money. Some of it's physical, some of it's electronic. And it's backed just by us saying, we're gonna pay you off at some point. And like I said, they often pay it off by, pay off the debt by just issuing new debt. So where am I going with this? logically speaking, yes, the amount of debt we have is a concern. The trajectory of it is a concern. The amount of debt we have is now larger than our gross domestic product, which is like all of the, I'm trying to equate this to like personal finance terms, but like the income of the country, if you want to think about it that way, it's the value of all the goods and services produced. So if you have more debt than we are actually producing or getting, it's like, well, this isn't sustainable. And to make it worse, as interest rates are rising, you know, the interest that has to be paid on all this debt is going up. And again, knowing that this isn't really paid off, it's just rolled and paid by new debt. It's just going to, you know, continue compounding if nothing gives. So on the surface, yes, problematic. I don't think anyone can say, no, the debt's not a problem at all, et cetera, et cetera. But it is very different because the U.S. is a government. It's a sovereignty. It can issue taxes. It has the right to issue debt. It's not like there's like you and I, you know, we're bound by how much money we actually bring in to pay our debts each month. If we don't have money, we're bankrupt and that's it. Well, like they can raise taxes to raise additional revenue. Now, the big problem with that is you can't tax your way to prosperity. You can't completely tax your way out of debt. Yes, maybe you can do some tax increases on the periphery, but at some point, like you can't raise taxes 100%, right? At the extremes, is this model breaks. So this is the ever difficult balance of like how much tax is the right amount, how much is too much, how much is too little, what's fair, what's not fair, how much do we need, how much is discretionary, just fluff spending. I'm trying to think where I'm going, where I intended to go with that. But what I'm saying is you can't really compare the government's debt and its income or GDP. You can't like equate that to a person, to an individual and their debt and their income from their wages or whatever, because it is a very different story. But that doesn't mean it's okay. That doesn't mean the debt isn't problematic. I come back to the U.S., for better or worse, is the, you know, as economy, as a country, as a currency, as a lender, is the beacon of relative safety. It's where the world over wants to put their money when they want or need stable, secure, what they believe to be stable and secure currency holdings, debt, investments, etc. So a large holder of U.S. government debt is Asian countries like Japan. I haven't looked recently, but when I last looked into this a few years ago, I think Japan was the largest foreign holder, followed by China, or maybe vice versa. They kind of toggle back and forth. And then, you know, a lot of other countries throughout the world want to hold U.S. government debt because, like I said, it's the relative beacon of safety and stability. You may be like, man, our debt's spiraling out of control. How are these countries still doing this? Well, what's the better alternative? If you're another country and you want or need to put your money somewhere relatively safe, what are your options? Where else are you going to put it, right? Stock market? No. I mean, stock market could do well, could do really bad. They got to invest in other countries, weaker countries with higher debt problems or less desirable currencies or weaker economies, et cetera. No, I don't think so. So what I'm trying to say, I guess, is as long as the U.S. as a country, as you know, a currency, meaning the dollar, as an issuer of debt, continues to be the flag bearer, you know, the standard of safety, quality, stability. Again, this is all relative. You may say the U.S. is a joke. How can you say it's safety and et cetera? Well, relatively speaking, what other country out there, what other currency, what other economy is close to usurping the U.S. as the major economic power, monetary power, relative beacon of safety, et cetera, et cetera? So, with that said, it's almost as if, and people are going to think I don't know what I'm talking about, and I may not. I mean, I could be extremely gullible, but this is so far how this has been playing out through the period while the debt's been increasing. Where else are people going to put their money? Like the U.S. having a lot of debt isn't a problem until it is. And that's the scary part, the until it is. And we don't know when the until it is going to happen. Can the U.S. be toppled economically? Monetarily, et cetera. It's possible. I'm not saying it's not, but at this point, I don't see any other country, economy, or currency coming close to unseating the U.S. as the global sort of standard bearer. The European Union was sort of on its way with the whole, you know, sort of United States of Europe concept where there's the European Union, which is the economic bloc, and the common currency, the euro, as countries were buying into that over the last, when did it start? I think it was 1998 that started, maybe 20, yeah, thereabouts, late 90s. That was an interesting experiment and it had a lot of potential upside and did have, in my opinion, the European Union could have been the major economic force collectively in the world, and its currency, the euro, could have been the major currency in the world. But that experiment, it's not unraveling, but that experiment is proving to not iron out as fruitful as hoped. Like some countries leaving the euro, Great Britain, for example, didn't use the euro, the currency, but it was in the European Union, the economic bloc. It left that. So, you know, if anything, the trend is for countries to sort of break away from the idea of the common economic bloc and common currency. So anyway, so what I'm saying is I don't think the eurozone or euro, the currency, is anywhere close to unseating the U.S. as the place people want and need to put money if they want safety and stability. China, perhaps, you know, China was really chugging along economically. You know, it's the second largest economy in the world and making great strides, but read headlines about China over the last year or so, it seems like it's, you know, paused or almost going backwards economically. So plus it's also a communist country. Now, I'm not a political expert. I don't know, you know, I guess it's communist technically, but it's sort of a quasi market-based, quasi communism. I don't really know. But my point is, I don't see China as an economy ever overtaking the US and, you know, a communist-based economy being the spot that the rest of the world views as the flag and standard bearer for safety, stability, free markets, et cetera, et cetera. So again, I could be gullible and naive, but I don't see China, the currency or the country, ever taking over the US in you know, our lifetimes. So what's left? There's really not much. There's, you know, some, I'll call them feeble attempts at, was it BRICS, Brazil, Russia, Iran, China, maybe, that were trying to band together and create their own currency and their own economic bloc. Like in theory, sure, there's power in numbers. But again, Brazil, Russia, Iran, China, I don't see that currency and that economic bloc being the place that the rest of the world, especially sort of free market, free, you know, free world, free markets, capitalist worlds are going to buy into for safety and stability, et cetera. Not to say that that bloc can't gain force and sway, but still, I don't know. I don't see it unseating the U.S. So is that a problem? Yes. You know, I don't know how this ends. I realize it sounds absurd for me to say it's not a problem until it is. And I don't know when it will be a problem, if it will be a problem. In the meantime, I realize like that just can't go ever upward without a stop. And, you know, how does that end? I don't know. I'm rambling now, as you can tell, because this is a complicated question with not a great answer. I mean, some of you listening may have said, well, the great answer is just stop spending so much. And sure, yeah. But realistically, is that going to happen? No. Regardless who's in office, you know, maybe there would be some cuts on the margins. But this isn't a political comment. This isn't a left versus right, blue versus red thing. It's just look at the debt trajectory over the last 20 years across all political administrations, and it's just gone up. The pandemic didn't help. So am I concerned about it? Yes. You know, grand sort of bigger picture, yes. Realistically, am I concerned about it and how it impacts retirees? I don't know. That's a tough one. I'm not letting it stop me. Let me put it that way. Like what are you going to do about it? Is I don't mean it to sound like a jerk, but like really, what are you going to do as the alternative? Buy gold? Buy crypto? Like, yes, there are some sort of doomsdayers that say gold is the spot to be. And if the world, you know, if the economy collapses, the dollar collapses, gold's where you want to be. And yeah, I get the argument in theory, but realistically, if we end up in this sort of Mad Max type scenario of living in the US day to day where you need gold because that's the only thing of value, we got much bigger problems than what's going to happen to your investable portfolio, in my opinion. So that's my thought about that. Crypto, I can't see crypto as a viable replacement, at least not yet, to the US dollar and the US as an economy and the place where people want to put money, because crypto is just, there's zero intrinsic value to it. Its only value is whatever people say they want to pay for it is what it's worth. And you may say, well, the US dollar is the same thing. Well, yeah, again, it's a fiat currency, but there's a centralized government banking system that in effect says what it's worth and sort of manipulates prices and the value of things to pin it to a certain amount of worth. You don't have that with crypto. Crypto is just a, you know, it could be any Yahoo in the world or a collection of Yahoos in the world could come together and sway the price of crypto if they really want to. Yeah. My other thought I had was, how does it impact the markets and retirees? I mean, unfortunately, we have this debt, not unfortunately, we have a debt limit ceiling, right? The government can only have so much borrowings. And you know this dog and pony show, it happens every now and again. The ceiling gets reached. We come to this 11th hour political posturing where both sides are sort of thumping their chest and saying, you're to blame, you're to blame. And what happens is the 11th hour, the ceiling gets increased. You know, no surprise, it always happens. And it's probably going to always happen. So part of me is like, just get rid of the stupid ceiling, because what's it actually doing anyway if we can just keep bumping it up every time? But point is, there's every time there's one of these debt ceiling dog and pony show chest thumping debacles, the markets get a little roiled for a while. And so what do you do about that? Yes, it stings and it hurts to watch, but it's short-term noise. Zoom out, look at the months around that, the years around that, and it's nothing more than short-term noise. So I wouldn't let the short-term or the long-term fear and potential impacts of the U.S. debt stop you from how you're currently investing and approaching and living life. Again, I'm sure there's a lot of you listening that say, you're an idiot. What are you saying? You know what we're talking about. But no one really knows how this is going to play out, how good or how bad it's going to be or when. Yes, the debt's a problem. Realistically, is it going to impact any of those of you listening who are, you know, 50 something or older in your retirements? I don't know. I don't think it will. But again, I can just be gullible and naive. So that's my thoughts on that, Kevin. Great question. You know, not a great answer, but highly sort of subjective, opinionated answers. Again, the monetary system, the whole concept of government debt is one big experiment, more or less, that's less than 100 years old. So, you know, we really don't know how this story ends. Could the U.S. be toppled economically, monetarily? Sure. If it does any of this stuff we're talking about really matter at that point? We're going to be like fending off people with sticks and living in bunkers and whatever. So, all right, that's that. Good question. Not a great answer, but thank you for that, Kevin. Next. All right, something more in our typical wheelhouse now, an investing in sort of retirement account question. So question is, I don't know if he gave permission to use his name, so I won't say it. 35-year-old contributing the max to his 403B. 403B. He has a 457 plan as well. No traditional IRAs. In addition to regular W-2 wages, makes about $50,000 in self-employment income, saying he cannot find a company such as Vanguard, Fidelity, et cetera, that is offering a SEP IRA in a Roth version. Do I know of any? So what is this? So I assume all of you listening are familiar with what an IRA is. It's a, you know, investable account. You're sort of meant for retirement. You get tax deferral on the money you put in historically. There's something called a SEP IRA, S-E-P, which stands for, I think, Small Employer Pension. For those who are self-employed or work at small employers, it's an IRA chassis, but it allows for larger contribution limits. It's not the normal like $7,000 or whatever that normal individual IRAs have. These SEP ones, because they're technically associated with a small employer, have larger limits to them. Thanks to Secure 2.0 Act, historically SEPs used to only be traditional in the sense that it was all pre-tax. You couldn't do Roth contributions to a SEP IRA. Well, that changed. And I believe it changed this year, effective 2024. So per the IRS, they now allow Roth versions of SEP IRAs. But the administrators who actually offer and run, you know, in custody and administer these SEP IRAs, I don't know if any of them actually offer the Roth flavor yet. They're allowed to because IRS says they can, but they don't have to. They're not forced to. So I think, I don't know any that do. So that's the answer to your question. But, and I don't know when they will either. I think they need to get their record keeping and, you know, systems and IT behind the scenes all up to snuff to make sure this works. I don't know what the timeline is. I assume some point in the next year or so, we'll probably see these start rolling out. But for the meantime, don't be surprised if you can't find any, especially in the large big name places that have Roth versions of SEP IRAs. And then there's another question I didn't quite grasp what you're asking. You asked, is there any limit on SEP IRA contribution? And you're not referring to the 25% limit or $69,000 total dollar limit. Sorry, I'm not sure what you're getting at with that part, but thank you for the first part. Next, another Kevin. This is not the Kevin from before. The other Kevin says, big fan of the show. Keep up the dad jokes. Thanks, Kevin. His question, is there a simple way to estimate income taxes during retirement? No, there's no simple way. There are definitely ways, but they are not simple, unfortunately. Well, I should say, the more complicated, the more less simple your financial circumstances are, the more non-simple or complicated the process of trying to estimate taxes will be. So Do you have any guidance? Are there any tools to help estimate taxes? Yes and yes. There's no shortcut around just having to manually sit down, maybe it's a few times a year, and plot out all of your anticipated sources of income for the year. And then also all of your tax withholdings, if any, you're going to have made for the year. And then look at the difference, what the total tax obligation is going to be, what your withholdings are going to be, if any. The difference is how much additional tax you're going to have to pay. That's your estimated taxes for the year. I'm really boiling it down, but that's it in a nutshell. Now, you do need some sort of tax calculator, tax software, unless you got the most simplest of you know scenarios, which most people probably don't. You do need something to calculate this for you. What tools are there? And I'm not recommending you use one over any of the other, but if you happen to use a commercial tax prep software such as TurboTax to do your taxes, they have a projection feature function. I mean, I don't use TurboTax. I haven't in like 20 years, so I don't know what it looks like, but I'm told they do. Where basically, you know, you just finish your 2023 taxes. You know what your, let's say you got a pension, Social Security, dividends and interest, whatever. There's a function within TurboTax. You may have to pay extra for it. I don't know. But you can basically say, okay, now project this into 2024. Assume these sources of income are the same. Let's piggyback off that. Project what it's going to look like in 2024. And then they'll let you tweak. Maybe you increase your dividends or interest or, you know, whatever. And it'll tell you what your estimated taxes should be or what your projected refund will be. So that's one option. Another one is there's a free, I think it's Excel-based, but like accessible directly through a website, 1040 calculator called Dinkytown, D-I-N-K-Y Town. Just Google Dinkytown 1040 and you'll find it. I don't know who makes it, but the guy is amazing. It's I think it's literally a guy. Maybe it's a team of people at this point, but it's an individual person who built and maintains and updates this fairly robust federal 1040, you know, tax return calculator online, completely free. You don't need to cough up any information or whatever. So that's something that can work. Now, I don't know if it does well for like self-employment income or rental income. If you got those, you may struggle to use that accurately. But if you just have like dividends, interest, Social Security, pensions, wages, basic stuff like that, that's a really, really good tool. It's accurate to my knowledge. Again, it's maintained, I think, for free. Maybe there's donations. I don't know. But kind of buyer beware on that. Otherwise, I mean, there's like other things. There's free tax. Just Google like free tax calculators and you can find stuff like it. But point is, you're going to ultimately need some engine, some calculator to do it. Whether it's Dinkytown, whether it's tax prep software, whether it's any other version of free tax software you find online, you're going to need one of those. So that's a fairly easy part, right? Finding one of those. The hard part for most people is estimating your various sources of income. Now, some things are easy. If you have Social Security, you know what that's going to be, you know, to the dollar. You know, you get a check every month. It's the same dollar amount every month. So you know that. You know your tax withholdings against it, if any, whatever you elected. Like, you can see those withholdings coming out of your monthly, payment. Pension, same thing. You know what your pension is. You know what taxes are withheld from it. Wages, not as simple because they're a little variable, especially if you get a bonus or whatever. But you can get a pretty good guesstimate of what your wages will be for the year. Same thing with the holdings. Just look at like your last paycheck and just sort of annualize that for the year to see how much was withheld and how much is going to be withheld. Where things get hard is dividends and interest, especially now with interest rates high. Maybe they stay high, maybe they don't. So you got money in a high yield savings account currently getting like 4.5%. Good. But you don't know now in April how much money you're going to have in that account every month for the rest of the year. You don't know what that rate's going to be every month for the rest of the year, right? So the best you can do now is make some sort of broad guesstimates, use your projection based on that broad estimate, but then you'll have to refine it later in the year. Or that's what I do like in practice with clients. This point now, early in the year, I'm just making educated guesses about dividends and interest. They will be wrong. So we meet again in, you know, October, November, December to refine things. Because by then, much more of the year will have passed. We'll know how much you actually received in dividends and interest up to that point. We'll have a better ability to project out the remaining month or two of the year to really sort of iron out and nail down the projection. So we do that. That's a difficulty. Another one is completely random stuff. Like, you have no idea that it's coming. Like, I don't know, maybe you start working later in the year as a consultant, you know, as some side hustle. You weren't planning on that earlier in the year, but yet now all of a sudden you get 50 grand of extra income. Yeah, that needs to be built into a revised projection later in the year. What else? Roth conversions. This is another big one. Like, some people aren't necessarily planning on doing Roth conversions for the year. And then the mood strikes them in December. You know, maybe the market tanks or some other reason they want to do a big conversion. All of a sudden now they do a $100,000 conversion they weren't planning on and therefore didn't pay estimated taxes for throughout the course of the year. So all this stuff, long way of saying, like, there is no shortcut. You need to manually grind out as accurate as possible estimates of your various sources of income for the year, knowing they'll need to be revised and tweaked throughout the year. And then also whatever your anticipated tax withholdings are for the year. So once you know your total income, you can figure out your total tax obligation using tax prep software. You'll also have guesstimates of what your withholdings will be. To the extent there's any shortfall in taxes, that's your estimated payments you need to make for the year. So I'll stop that one there. But no, there's not an easy way to do this, Kevin. It does take homework and research and some manual effort for better or worse. Next question from Tom. This is an interesting one. This is one of those like optimization of optimization of optimization ones. It's interesting to think about, but it makes your head hurt in practice if you try to actually do this. So see if I can sum this up. Maybe not. Maybe I'll just read it out, whole thing. So trying to determine if tax-exempt bonds or money market funds provide an equal or better rate of return than the non-tax-free versions always seemed a bit of a crapshoot, as rates could change and your tax brackets can change. So I'll pause there for a moment. What he's referring to is when you have a regular brokerage account, not a qualified account like an IRA or Roth IRA, but just like a normal after-tax brokerage account, interest you get on bonds or mutual funds that invest in bonds, for example, may or may not be taxable federally or at the state. It depends. So we'll just talk about federal for now. We'll disregard state. But if you get interest from U.S. government bonds, that's fully taxable federally. If you get interest from corporate bonds, that's fully taxable federally. If you get interest from municipal bonds, like a bond issued by a local state or municipality, that's generally not, there are some rare exceptions, but generally that interest is not taxable federally. So what Tom's getting at is if you can get 10% interest, I'm just making up a number, but 10% interest on a corporate bond, it's going to be fully taxed. And let's assume your tax rate's 30%. So net of tax, you're only getting 7% interest on that corporate bond. So there's like this tax equivalent yield or after-tax yield or tax-free yield with you have to do between municipal bonds and corporate bonds. So if you can get a municipal bond paying 7% interest and there's no tax on it, net of tax, you're getting 7% on that municipal bond versus, again, the corporate bond, if you get 10% interest but pay 30% tax, you're netting out the same 7% net of tax interest. So you can't look at interest rates on municipal bonds or corporate bonds on a pari passu, even basis, because there's a tax differential to it. So that's sort of the background of Tom's question here. So he's just saying, it got me thinking, but we don't know this because like the rates on these bonds can change, your own tax situation can change. So just because, one may look better now, it doesn't mean it's always going to be the case. So Tom goes on, it got me thinking about some of the limits, cliffs and phase outs in the tax code that look at your modified adjusted gross income. I wondered if modified adjusted gross income is in part based on a gross amount for income regardless of its taxability. Would tax-free income be better in a lot of cases if you are near those limits or cliffs, even if it wasn't quite as attractive a return as a taxable option? And then he gives an example, which I'll sort of summarize here. So what Tom's getting at is a corporate bond net of taxes might be slightly better after-tax return than municipal interest. So for example, let's again assume a corporate bond's paying 10% interest and you have 25% tax only. Net of tax, you get $7,500 of interest. Again, 10,000 gross interest, but 7,500 like net of the taxes you have to pay on it. Let's assume a municipal bond only pays 7% interest. So you're getting, $7,000 of gross interest from that bond, but there's no federal tax. So you're actually keeping $7,000 of it. The corporate bond still looks better from a pure tax perspective because net of tax, you're keeping more. But Tom's angle here is, and Tom's question is, but when you look at things, other parts of the tax code that look at your total modified adjusted gross income, such as the Medicare premium surcharges known as IRMA, or for those on Affordable Care Act insurance, you may be eligible for tax credit subsidies that look at your modified adjusted gross income. Both of those measures of modified adjusted gross income look at, or they, I should say, they include the amount of tax-exempt interest into the mix. Like they add those in. So what Tom's saying is, in some sense, even though from a pure after-tax perspective, you may be netting more interest on the corporate bond than the municipal bond, that corporate bond has $3,000 more of gross income on a modified adjusted gross income basis than do these municipal bonds. So if you are on Medicare and your gross income is really close to one of these income levels where you get bumped up into the next surcharge bracket, it could be the case that it's ultimately better for you to have interest from municipal bonds instead of corporate bonds. Well, even though the corporate bonds may have a higher net of tax return, factoring in the higher Medicare premiums they're gonna lead to, you might end up being better with the municipal bonds. You follow that? This one's out there. This is one of those, like, yeah, in theory, I get what you're saying, Tom, and I agree. This needs to be taken into account. You know, Medicare surcharges, for example, and these cliffs and thresholds in the tax code need to be taken into account. But in reality, man, this will just, like, you'll spin your wheels and make your head hurt trying to optimize this. It could be done in theory, but it's going to be really hard. Like any tax thing, any action you take is going to have an impact on something else. Like none of these decisions and none of these tax impacts could be made or happen in isolation, because they all sort of have knock-on effects to other things. So yeah, I see what you're saying. I agree with you. In theory, if you can get that granular and accurate with your projections and tax forecasts and stuff and whatever, Tom, sure, the municipal bonds could end up being better, even though they're purely, you know, net of tax return is lower than corporate bonds. So good question, comment. In reality, it's like, yeah, I struggle to see how this is going to be feasible to do, but in theory, yes, what you're saying makes sense. And then I'll add this here because I think it's helpful. So Tom also added some comments. He's saying, Tom's an active member of the Facebook group. Said that there's a lot of comments about trust and people asking, do I need a trust? They're referring to the living revocable kind of trust, asking if they need it, et cetera. And this is a hot topic. There's really often strong opinions and mixed views on this, but Tom's just adding in some food for thought and points of support about a trust. So he has four things to add here. One is, if you own property in more than one state and perhaps even more than one county, the trust can prevent the need to open up multiple probate estates. So that's a good point. If you have assets in multiple states, like you own a home in Florida and you know another home in New Jersey, I believe when you die that you'll have to go to probate in both. Well, I guess it depends on the state. Some states have like fast tracked or really short probates, or, you know, minimums where if your total estate size is under a certain amount, I don't know that there's a probate process. But in theory, yes, if you have a lot of assets in a lot of states, having a trust could help you minimize or avoid having to do the probate process in multiple states. Though, then I have the question, I don't know the answer. How, like, trusts are governed by the state in which you live, I believe. So if you die and you have sizable assets in two states, you only have one trust, which state governs a trust? Or does it matter? Like, in reality, do most of them end up getting facilitated the same? I don't know, just thinking out loud. But yeah, good point on number one, Tom. Number two, probate is public, trusts are private. So a trust can keep your settlement and other important information out of the public eye. That is correct. For many people, they don't care about the privacy aspect, but yeah, when you die and you go to probate, like, you don't have a trust, like your house, you know, passes through the will, your bank accounts pass through the will, all that stuff is public info. Again, some people don't care, but if you do, you don't want the public to be able to know about it. Having a trust can keep all of this stuff private. Interesting example, Cody Garrett from the group mentioned that his, I believe his grandmother passed a few years ago and her house went through probate. You know, she didn't have a trust that the house was in. And Cody, as the executor, was getting a bunch of random cold calls and emails from realtors who were trying to sell the grandma's house. Because knowing that, you know, it's public, you can go to the court, I guess, and ask, or maybe they have a website. You can find out who died and what assets they had that went through probate. And so for example, you know, the realtors went and looked and find people who die and say, oh, they have a house, they're probably going to sell it now. Let me go hit up the executor to see if I can be able to sell the house for them. So that's an example of, had the house been in a trust and Cody's grandmother died that way, you know, having the house in the trust, no realtors, no public would know the fact that she owned a house that passed to the heirs. So again, many people don't care about that, but for those that do, a trust will help because it is private. Three, if you are incapacitated, the trust can be a simpler way for someone else to take over your financial affairs. Yeah, yeah, I guess that sounds right. So even if you don't have a trust, you can have like a durable power of attorney or whatever the equivalent is for medical issues. And in theory, yes, that person steps in once you're no longer capable of making your own decisions. But in a trust, you don't have to worry about that. Like you can have co-trustees, for example, where once one person's incompetent, the other trust is like already has the power to do whatever and administer all the stuff in the trust. And point four, I felt like the trust gave me more control over how to structure my estate. I don't have any desire to control from the grave, but it somehow felt more empowering than when I did just wills. Perhaps this is more psychological than practical. Yep. So, you know, this is Tom's way of saying, I don't know that there's actual additional value in having control with the trust versus the will. He doesn't want control per se, but it feels like to him that there is some more control with it. And there is value, like the emotional and tangible value of things is very real. Whether or not you have a trust, whether or not you invest in something, you know, Aversb, whether or not you have an advisor or not, like the intangible stuff is very much real. So don't let someone tell you it's wrong for you if you feel like it has value for you. All right, that was it for Tom. Two more questions. These are ones I just pulled from the Facebook group because I thought they were interesting and worth talking about. One is, how much is too much to have in a health savings account or HSA? That got me thinking. So I don't know if there is a too much. Health savings account is probably the most tax efficient retirement account there is. Now notice I said retirement account. It wasn't intended to be a retirement account, but you can very much use it as such. So health savings account, not everyone's eligible. A lot of people aren't. You have to have a qualifying high deductible health insurance plan, which many people don't. But if you do, you can open up an HSA and put money in it. Now, an HSA has a lot of tax benefits. There's deferral, you know, deduction of the money you put into it. The growth along the way isn't taxed as it happens. All of the money you eventually take out is tax-free if you use it to pay for qualifying medical expenses or reimburse yourself for qualifying medical expenses. And the fourth potential tax benefit is if you have an HSA through work, specifically through your employer's what's called Cafeteria 120, Section 125 cafeteria plan. If you contribute to it that way, the contributions you make not only reduce your income tax, but they also are not subject to payroll taxes. So you don't have to pay Social Security and Medicare tax on it. So very tax advantaged. And you can, it's sort of like an IRA. You have an HSA at some financial custodian. Depending on the custodian, they'll have a menu of things you can invest in. Some have no limit. You can invest in whatever, basically. So you can open an HSA in your 20s and your 30s and your 40s, fund it every year. There are limits to how much you can put in, depending on whether you have a single coverage or family coverage. I won't get into that, but you can fund it throughout your working years, invest it potentially aggressively, let it sit and bake and grow, and use it later in retirement. Even after you stop working, you can just let it sit there and stay invested. And then eventually you can take money out in retirement to pay for Medicare premiums. You can't pay for Medigap premiums, but you can pay for base Medicare premiums. You can pay for all your other qualifying out-of-pocket medical expenses, you know, co-pays, co-insurance, medical devices, drugs, et cetera. So because it's so tax advantaged, it's often a good planning opportunity to put the money in, invest aggressively, let it sit for the long term. You are able to take money out every year from HSA to pay for, you know, qualifying expenses as you have them. But knowing it's so tax advantage, there's a really strong argument to be made that this is like the money you should let sit and really grow and have all that growth be eventually tax-free. So then the question is, well, how much is too much? Well, I mean, I don't know if there is too much. Because HSAs are relatively new and because of the annual limits on it, I don't know that it's possible, but it's exceptionally rare to see someone with an HSA that's in six figures. It's possible again, but most are, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. But in theory, yeah, if you have $1 million in HSA, that could be overdoing it. Because again, in order for the distributions to be tax-free, they need to be to pay for or reimburse qualified medical expenses you have or had. So unless you're going to have like hundreds of thousands of dollars of medical expenses in your life, which you might, but many people don't. You know, that could be too much in the HSA. Now, if you're married, when you die and you're the HSA holder, when you die, your spouse can inherit the HSA from you. And in his or her hands, it'll continue to look and act like an HSA, meaning he or she can still take money out throughout the rest of their life to pay or reimburse qualified medical expenses. where HSAs are lose their tax efficiency is when you die and it's someone other than your spouse that inherits it. So let's say you're single, you have an HSA and you die, you leave it to your kids. Well, all that magic tax freeness of the HSA goes away. The HSA is fully taxable in their hands as they distribute it, and they only have a year to do it. I forget if it's a year from death or like the calendar year of death or calendar year after death, but basically it's like a year, give or take, that your beneficiaries have to empty the HSA, and it's all fully taxable to them. Now, there is a bit of a saving grace here where I forget the specifics. I looked it up a few months ago, but I forgot. If you have medical expenses that you did not yet reimburse yourself from with the HSA before you died, I believe your heirs can take money out of the HSA to cover, to in effect reimburse the expenses you had. Now, that's going to require detailed and meticulous record keeping of expenses to know what expenses you had, what you reimbursed yourself for, what you didn't. So in reality, I doubt many people are going to have the record keeping to do that accurately, but in theory, it could be done. So sorry, I'm wrapping up here. How much is too much? In a perfect world, if you're married, you want to have enough that the second to die depletes the HSA by the time they die. Again, you ideally don't want to leave it to someone because it's going to be fully taxed. Unless you leave it to a charity, they don't pay tax. But if you're single, same thing. I mean, save up as much as you can, save it for retirement, and ideally spend it down, you know, right around the time you die. Now, the difficulty with that is you don't know when you're going to leave this world. So it, you know, kind of makes it hard to know exactly when to start tapping your HSA and by how much. But, you know, that's sort of the gist behind it. As much as you can get in there, good. Because no, again, you can use it to pay for medical expenses in retirement and even reimburse yourself for expenses you had before retirement. As long as the expense was incurred after you had an HSA, you can simply save up receipts for the rest of your life and reimburse yourself for those 30 years down the road, pull money out of your HSA at the time. So, you know, in that sense, there isn't the concept of having too much other than you don't want to die with a lot in your HSA because it's not very tax efficient to leave to people. And final question, also from the Facebook group. Regarding RMDs, required minimum distribution. So you have an IRA, a 401k, whatever it is, doesn't matter. Question is, when I'm subject to RMDs, you know, I get of an age, I need to start taking RMDs. Is it better to take them sort of frequently throughout the year or all at once? And this is an interesting one. There is no obvious or right answer. A lot of it's personal preference. So if you want the look and feel of like a monthly paycheck, then you know, you're probably going to get more value in comfort and benefit out of doing like a recurring monthly distribution out of your account. Or if you don't really care about that, maybe you want it quarterly, maybe you want it once a year. So I work with some people, they just want like one big fat slug of cash deposited into their bank account at the beginning of the year. They'll then sort of spend it down at will throughout the year. And then when the next year comes, we do another big distribution. So really all depends. But one thing to think about, and this sort of smells of market timing, so don't put too much stake in this, but all else equal, assuming your account is invested well, generally speaking, the stock and bond market go up, or historically have gone up more than they've gone down. So that would lead you to believe that it's better to leave money in your account as long as, again, generally speaking, there's bad years where this holds the opposite. But generally speaking, it would be better to leave as much money in your account as long as possible to let it grow, get interest, etc. So that would mean, you know, in a purely sort of academic historical world, taking your RMD in one slug as late in the year as possible would likely historically have given you the most portfolio growth over your life. Now, you may not care about that, and it could be splitting hairs about that. Again, some years are opposite, like 2022 was a terrible year for stock and bond market. In that case, it would have been better to take your RMD out all at the beginning of the year and not drib and drab it out throughout the course of the year. But hindsight's 2020. So do what works for you. Whether you take out one big slug, you know, take out the whole RMD once during the course of the year, or take it out in like 12 monthly payments, it's not going to make or break your plans. You know, that alone won't. So do whatever makes the most sense for you from a cash flow, timing wise, comfort wise, whatever. That's the right answer for you. All right. That's it for this week's episode. I hope you found this good. I knew that one about the debt would be interesting. I knew I'd ramble about it because it's hard to come up with and articulate concise thoughts about it. But I thought it was worth addressing because I'm sure many of you have thoughts and concerns about that. So I gave you my two cents. Again, you could tell me I'm an idiot, and who knows, I might be with my views about the debt ceiling and national debt, but so goes it. Anyway, as always, if you like this podcast, I would greatly appreciate it if you take a couple mementos to leave a nice review, a write-up, a thumbs up, a like, a five-star, whatever, on whatever podcast listening platform you use to digest this. And if you haven't already, checked out the retirementplanningeducation.com website, where you can find a whole bunch of free stuff, including there's a summary on there about modified adjusted gross incomes, you know, the most common ones in retirement and what goes into them. So you can see what I was talking about before with tax-exempt interest getting added into gross income for purposes of a few different measures. And there's also there, you know, link to the YouTube channel, Facebook group, and then this podcast, which obviously you know about. And that's it. I'm done. Thank you as always for listening. I will see you next time.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.